Soon after graduation, I became the managing editor of a policy magazine and began to write freelance articles in the Washington Post. Someone in the Reagan White House was apparently impressed by my work because I was called in for an interview and promptly hired as a senior domestic policy analyst. I found it strange to be working at the White House because at the time I was not a U.S. citizen. I am sure that such a thing would not happen in India or anywhere else in the world. But Reagan and his people didn't seem to mind. For them, ideology counted more than nationality. I also met my future wife in the Reagan administration, where she was at the time a White House intern. She has since deleted it from her resume. My wife was born in Louisiana and grew up in San Diego. Her ancestry is English, French, Scot-Irish, German, and American Indian. I noticed that Americans marry in a rather peculiar way, by falling in love. You may think that I am being ironic or putting you on, so let me hasten to inform you that in many parts of the world, romantic love is considered a mild form of insanity. Consider a typical situation. Anjali is in love with Arjun. She considers Arjun the best-looking man in the world, the most intelligent, virtually without fault, a paragon of humanity. But everybody else can see that Arjun is none of these things. What then persuades Anjali that Arjun possesses qualities that are nowhere in evidence? There is only one explanation. Anjali is deeply deluded. It does not follow that her romantic impulses should be ruthlessly crushed. But in the view of many people and many traditions around the world, they should be steered and directed and prevented from ruining Anjali's life. This is the job of parents and the community, to help Anjali see beyond her delusions and to make decisions that are based on practical considerations and common sense. If there is a single phrase that encapsulates life in the third world, it is that birth is destiny. I remember an incident years ago when my grandfather called in my brother, my sister, and me and asked us if we knew how lucky we were. We asked him why he felt this way. Was it because we were intelligent, or had lots of friends, or were blessed with a loving family? Each time he shook his head and said no. Finally, we pressed him, why did he consider us so lucky? Then he revealed the answer, because you are Brahmins. The Brahmin, who is the highest ranking in the Hindu caste system, is traditionally a member of the priestly class. As a matter of fact, my family had nothing to do with the priesthood, nor are we Hindu. My ancestors converted to Christianity many generations ago. Even so, my grandfather's point was that before we converted, hundreds of years ago, our family used to be Brahmins. How he knew this remains a mystery, but he was serious in his insistence that nothing that the three of us achieved in life could possibly mean more than the fact that we were Brahmins. This may seem like an extreme example, revealing my grandfather to be a very narrow fellow indeed, but the broader point is that traditional cultures attach a great deal of importance to data such as what tribe you come from, whether you are male or female, and whether you are the eldest son. Your destiny and your happiness hinge on these things. If you are Bengali, you can count on other Bengalis to help you, and on others to discriminate against you. If you are female, then certain forms of society and several professions are closed to you. And if you are the eldest son, you inherit the family house, and your siblings are expected to follow your direction. What this means is that once your tribe, caste, sex, and family position have been established at birth, your life takes a course that is largely determined for you. In America, by contrast, you get to write the script of your own life. When your parents say to you, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" the question is open-ended. It is you who supply the answer. Your parents can advise you, "Have you considered law school? Why not become the first doctor in the family?" It is considered very improper, however, for them to try and force your decision. Indeed, American parents typically send their teenage children to college, where they live on their own and learn independence. This is part of the process of forming your mind and choosing a field of interest for yourself and developing your identity. It is not uncommon in the United States for two brothers who come from the same gene pool and were raised in similar circumstances to do quite different things. The eldest becomes a gas station attendant. The younger moves up to be vice president at Oracle. The eldest marries his high school sweetheart and raises 4 kids. The youngest refuses to settle down or comes out of the closet as a homosexual. One is the Methodist that he was raised to be. The other becomes a Christian Scientist or a Buddhist. What to be, where to live, whom to love, whom to marry, what to believe, what religion to practice. These are all decisions that Americans make for themselves. In most parts of the world, your identity and your fate are to a large degree handed to you. In America, you determine them for yourself. In America, your destiny is not prescribed, it is constructed. Your life is like a blank sheet of paper, and you are the artist. This notion of you being the architect of your own destiny is the incredibly powerful idea that is behind the worldwide appeal of America. Young people especially find irresistible the prospect of being in the driver's seat, of authoring the narrative of their own lives. So too the immigrant discovers that America permits him to break free of the constraints that have held him captive, so that the future becomes a landscape of his own choosing. The phrase that captures this unique aspect of America is the pursuit of happiness. Nobel laureate V.S. Naipaul analyzes the concept in this way. It is an elastic idea. It fits all men. It implies a certain kind of society, a certain kind of awakened spirit. So much is contained in it, the idea of the individual, responsibility, choice, the life of the intellect, the idea of vocation and perfectibility and achievement. It is an immense human idea. It cannot be reduced to a fixed system. It cannot generate fanaticism. But it is known to exist. And because of that, other, more rigid systems, in the end, blow away. But where did the pursuit of happiness come from? How did America develop a unique framework for enabling people to shape their own destiny? I have been speaking autobiographically, so let me put the question in a more general way. Consider New York City. It is a tumultuous place, teeming with diversity. Wall Street hustlers, struggling artists, Pakistani cab drivers, female book editors, philosophically minded barbers, elderly women walking dogs, Big Tony with the hairy armpits serving pizza, and eccentrics of every stripe. New York has black and white, rich and poor, immigrant and native. I notice 2 striking things about these people. They are energetic, hardworking, opportunistic. They want to succeed and believe there is a good chance they can. Second, for all their profound differences, they all manage somehow to get along. This raises a question about New York and about America. How does it manage to reconcile such fantastic ethnic and religious and socio-economic diversity and give hope and inspiration to so many people from all over the world? I intend to answer this question, but first I want to mention a darker side of New York and America that has not escaped the attention of their critics. To the Islamic fundamentalist, the most striking aspect about New York is not its wealth or its diversity, but its debauchery. From the point of view of many Muslims and of some American conservatives too, New York City is Sin City. Their debauchery seems not only prevalent, but even worse, it seems socially accepted. This raises Saeed Qutb's argument that America may be a peaceful and a prosperous society, but it is fundamentally an immoral society. Qutb would not be impressed by New York's great productivity or its varied cuisine or the fact that people of different backgrounds get along together. He would dismiss all this as worthless triviality. He makes his argument on the highest level. In the good society, he contends, it is God and not man who rules. God is the source of all authority, including legitimate political authority. Virtue, not freedom, is the highest value. Therefore, God's commands, not man's laws, should govern the society. The goal of the regime is to make people better, not to make them better off. Qutb's theocratic argument falls harshly on American ears, but let us recall that it is substantially the argument made by Plato and the classical philosophers, who argued that the best regime is devoted to inculcating virtue. Plato's argument is that the ideal arrangement for a society is to have the wise people as rulers. No one can be against this, especially in view of the alternative, which is rule of the stupid or unwise. In Plato's view, the wisest people are necessarily a small minority. In particular, they are the philosophers. Plato's argument against democracy is that it mistakes quantity for quality.